Welcome to Hedson's Living Histories podcast, capturing and sharing the life stories of people who have used or worked in NHS mental health services in Sussex, following the closure of the old asylums in the 1980s, up to and including the COVID-19 pandemic and its aftermath. By listening to people tell us, in their own words, about their experiences, we explore the complex interplay between mental health and a life well lived. Over the course of a year, Living Histories volunteers have recorded 35 in-depth oral history interviews across Sussex, opening up new ways to reflect on the past, present and future impact of mental health on people's lives. The full interviews will remain sealed for 80 years in the Mass Observation Archive at the Keep, housed in the University of Sussex. But in these podcasts, with the permission of the interviewees, we present some of their memories, experiences and reflections for the first time. You might find some of the stories you hear challenging, as participants talk openly about the difficulties of living with mental ill health. Please be aware that topics including mental health crisis, suicide, abuse and neglect are covered in these episodes. Living Histories celebrates the strength, courage and resilience of people living with mental health problems and those caring for them. Our huge thanks to everyone who told their story. This episode, The Unseen Condition, explores the stigma surrounding mental health and the impact this has on people's lives, both whilst unwell and into recovery, from the 1980s up to the present day. We hear personal accounts of direct discrimination because of people's mental health needs and the barriers people can face as they try to move forwards with their lives. It asks us all to consider how can we embrace and normalise mental ill health, recognising that to live with a mental health condition brings challenge enough of its own.
The brain, you can't see what's going on. Broken arm, broken limb, facial disfigurement, anything like that, wheelchair, walking stick, you've got these visual. The brain is unpredictable. If somebody has a tumour and they can operate and the tumour's gone, or if there's carcinoma tumour, it's all four, it can be treated, people can see you're going through it, but there's hope. But with the brain, people don't know how somebody's going to react. Don't leave me alone with them. Well, what do you think is going to happen? Yeah, and it's the fear. Because it's like somebody saying there's a mouse in the room, but you don't know where this mouse is and you're looking. It's that fear. It's the unseen condition that frightens people. And people don't know how to deal with it. None of us know until you actually get to know that person.
Yeah, I live with my friends and family from day to day. Their outlook on me, the way they judge me, and the way that the impression I have on them is so important. And some people are really kind, you know, they're so sympathetic. Bless them, it's really nice. But some people just, you know it, you know, they keep you at arm's length. They sort of see that there's something wrong with you or something like that. That's how I feel. You know, and again, it might be me being a bit paranoid about it, I don't know. But there is that. And I don't knock it because people don't understand. Some people are set in their ways, you know, and they don't want to go and learn about it. So they avoid. So that's why I don't want to share stuff, you know.
There are so many problems that come out of mental health, and that's before we've even touched on the stigma that goes along with mental health, despite what enlightened society would like to think. What was it? My grandmother always used to say, there but for the grace of God.
I don't feel like people fully understand it. I think maybe there's more of a fashion trend on it. Even with conversations of anxiety, and I've had anxiety disorders, again, until 30, I didn't really understand it. And I think people just see the headline, oh, anxiety, I've got that. But there's so much more to it. It's like if it's prolonged, it becomes a disorder, and that needs to deal with, because then that will come to mental ill health. And none of that really gets explained. It's just a quick self-diagnosis. Oh, I've got anxiety.
I think social media had a great impact. I think COVID had a great impact. Parents not feeling safe to let their children out. It's just changed. Even though maybe you would say in many ways, young people have got there's so much going. I think they're much more sophisticated, but then there's lacking in other ways as well. And I do feel sorry for young people. And I do feel sorry that they're going to have the influence of internet and people doing and saying things. How do you deal with all of that? But I do think there's more young people coming into the service. Who knows where it's all going to go?
I also see it as a community, as a societal aspect of how we hold people who are in pain, that it's not just about healing. Nobody's fully whole. And some people have more limitations than others, and how as a society we can hold that and make that okay. And that itself is healing, when people feel accepted. So I think there's scope, but I don't think everyone at all is going to get fully healed. And so what do we do with that? How do we allow for people who may be not the usual norm? So this is bigger than just mental illnesses, odd behaviours that we might consider abnormal in society that are in other cultures or subcultures could be okay.
If people have had experience, you know, they might have lived next door to someone who, you know, perhaps has been very acutely unwell and psychotic and is loud and noisy and shouty, their ability to be rather more compassionate is tainted by that, or they've been out and been accosted by someone, you know, who's under the influence of, you know, their voices and being aggressive and violent, you know, go, oh, yeah, they should be locked up and the key thrown away because they've come across that. And likewise, things like trauma. Although I think there's perhaps greater awareness now, the trauma of, you know, events, you know, like abuse, like, you know, sexual assault, like childhood has on people and how that can then impact them and stuff. And I think sometimes if people have had negative personal experiences, that will influence how they see mental health and treatment and care and provision and what should or shouldn't be done.
I just don't think people would have gone to the doctors with a mental health problem. It would probably only be people who became psychotic or something, or that ended up being sectioned or whatever. That's probably the only type of person you would know. You probably wouldn't be allowed to have anxiety if you live with my mother, but I think that was typical of the time, wasn't it? You would never say, oh, I've got a headache, or oh, I feel too anxious to go into school today. It would be, you're going, you know, just different. It was just a different time. I don't know whether it's helpful now that everyone very quickly jumps on the bandwagon to have a mental illness, or I think we probably had a lot more resilience. I don't know. I think times are different. There's a lot of social media. There are lots of influences in people's lives that they can't control. There wasn't that when I was young.
I was working in a room, a data preparation room of 70 girls, and I had my first promotion was I had my own group, a section of girls, and I had 12 girls in charge of. And we had people there with a lot of mental health problems. And I actually became quite caring about them. They weren't treated properly because we didn't understand. Some people were ridiculed or just dismissed. And I'm talking the 70s, I suppose. People weren't treated properly at all. One of my girls did commit suicide. I did try and look after her. People didn't really understand it in those days. There were some eccentric people, what they called eccentric people, who had peculiar behaviours. It wasn't understood.
Late 80s, early 90s, you could pick your job and your salary. It was a really good time. So I got this job, and it was the first big corporate company that it was a 13-storey building on the Hammersmith flyover. It was, you know, very corporate. And I was doing absolutely fine. I was doing really well. And I'd been working there about 3 months, and my line manager, whatever they were called then, said, oh, when you started work, you didn't fill out a health questionnaire. I was already employed. And it said something like, have you ever had a mental health problem or suffered from depression, whatever wording they used back then. And I, of course, in my absolute naivety, said yes. And then it said explain more. And I said, oh, you know, I just spent 18 months in hospital, but, you know, I'm fine now. I was immediately hauled up before HR, who sacked me and said that it was quite clear that there was no way I could do the job. But I'd already been doing it for about 3 months by this stage. I went to Mind and I asked Mind to see whether or not what they'd done was legal. And it turned out it wasn't legal because I had already started work. And then they called in a psychiatrist, and I had to sit with him for about an hour and a half, and he was horrible. And he said things like, what makes you think you can cope with real life? You know, things like that. And I kind of had to give them a promise that I was less likely to have a breakdown than anybody else because I'd already had one. But really, the only thing that saved that job was the fact that they'd already employed me and they didn't give me the medical form when they should have done.
I was seeing my GP and she basically said to me when I talked about how I've been feeling and what I was like, she said, don't tell me anymore because I'll have to refer you to secondary services. So I stopped talking about it. I was told again in my 30s not to say any more to my GP because I'd have to be referred and I would lose my career. I was very limited with what I shared, and because I didn't fully understand what was going on for myself, I didn't know how to put words on it, it just made me more determined to try and, you know, channel this into helping other people to have a better life.
I was 48 when I had my, what I call a breakdown. I was really in a high up position in my job. I was a woman in a man's world. No woman had taken on that position before on that site. I was in line for a further promotion, which was a very high up promotion. And the more I did, the more the men I was working with put on me, less staff, more work. And I just started to very slowly crumble, really, I suppose. That's all that happened. I went on a course for women in management who are working, and I said to them, I go home and I do my washing Thursday nights, and Friday nights I leave work about 7. I go to the supermarket and get all my shopping. My husband's on shift work. I come home and get the meal. I then start my ironing about 12 o'clock at night. And they said to me, you're going to have a breakdown. No, I'm not. I've got my job, I've got the house, I've got to do all this. These women I was working with said, you can't go on like this. But that was just a warning. I was just piling it all on, trying to do everything.
There was huge stigma. And I do question whether I would have got the job if I opened up about it. That's my personal opinion. The school that I work for have never said anything on them. And it's not even in the job application form that they question it. But I think being aware of stigma, especially around psychosis, yeah, it's quite damaging.
I think I still felt that this whole of the psychiatric and mental health service institution had got the whole thing wrong. What we were trying to do was get people who were basically suffering from life and distress and suffering from everybody around them to be able to get back some semblance of control in their lives by teaching them techniques, by enabling them to see their distress as something that will pass and is normal anyway, by getting to see their
their psychosis as something that is just a spectrum of normal human behaviour.
My dad found an old violin from the family from years before, and inside it, my birth name was Eakins, and inside it said Nutter Eakins. And it said Nutter Eakins because obviously the Nutters used to be the people that would collect the nuts, and they tended to be the people that preferred to be on the edge of society, on their own, living closer to the land. Doing so, whether they were a bit more unusual before they became the Nutter, or because of that isolation they became a little bit more feared or scared, it would build up. And all of those things are a matter of perspective. So if you hear voices and you live in a different culture, you would be the most revered person. It is the what it means to you and how you deal with it that's important. And we are all people, and most of this is all quite normal.
Or I took the minibus out with a group of people to Midhurst. Now, Midhurst is a very middle-class area. Took them into a coffee shop. Nobody wanted to serve them. And there'd be one there going, with a fag. You know, and they would be peering around. If we leave them long enough, maybe they'd leave, and we would sit there and wait until they came out. Yeah. And we'd sit there until they had to come and serve us. So, yeah, there was lots of incidents. People think they have more understanding about mental health, but that's more the lower level, something that's controllable, but not necessarily people like that, you know, that were quite really institutionalised. But some people were really, really nice.
Ecology work is interesting because it's how does nature work? And with nature, you want to understand what's already there. It's like you're going into a garden that's working fine and you're coming with all this machinery to carve it into what you think it should be without seeing what's naturally growing well, and therefore you're not using the support that nature's already offering you. The patterns already are established, so it takes a certain paradigm of domination. And that's why we have an ecological crisis, and that's why we have a social crisis. And so there's something fundamental that goes against my beliefs here of someone who believes that they should be working that way just because they have the authority and rank.
The expectations of psychiatry has also been changing. So there's a whole tsunami going on at the moment of referrals around ADHD and ASD and services which simply they haven't been beefed up by way of resources to cater for this. What do we mean by psychiatry now? When do we turn to a professional in mental health? And when is it more of a mental fitness? In a similar way, you could be physically unfit and you need development and you need exercises and you need to do something about it. But it doesn't mean we can call you disordered. If you remain like that, you might become disordered. I think we're sort of gathering a lot of more and more psychosocial issues now under the umbrella of mental health and psychiatry. And I'm not quite sure where that line is going to be drawn when you're providing a service. Clearly, we cannot deal with all the homelessness and you know, in the county. We cannot deal with all the relationship problems in the county. There's a lot of things going on there, which are actually society's shared responsibility.
I'm a big fan of the Tao Te Ching, the ancient Chinese philosophy that follows the middle way, where you are allowing all voices to be heard. You're allowing that sense of belief in the good of humankind, and that people will come to understand things in their own way. It's really down to people to identify in whatever way feels right for them. I understand absolutely why a lot of survivors of the mental health system wouldn't want to identify as a disabled person. And I really worry for what's happening now with the government saying it's committed to reducing the amount that's spent on PIP and on benefits generally, and I really worry, especially for people who are in that ambivalent situation of don't really want to see themselves as disabled, because that somehow seems to be about admitting defeat. And at the same time, kind of relate to the idea of mental illness. It's very, very difficult, I think, for people in those communities to navigate that journey into a kind of a self-affirming identity that affords power and respect.
This episode of Heads On's Living Histories podcast was produced as part of a collaboration between Heads On and Sussex Partnership NHS Foundation Trust. Living Histories was funded by the National Lottery Heritage Fund, NHS Charities Together, and Heads On. We're deeply grateful to all the participants who shared their stories, and to the many staff, volunteers, and project partners who have made Living Histories possible. If you found this episode interesting and would like to hear more, please visit www.headsoncharity.org/histories, where you can learn more about Living Histories and listen to other episodes. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, support is available. Please visit www.sussexpartnership.nhs.uk/your-mental-health/getting-help. Audio production by Charlotte Petz and Michael Umney. Music by Chad Crouch. Narration by Living Histories volunteer Ian Barnett. Oral history clips taken from full interviews with project participants from across Sussex for Heads On's Living Histories. For more information about Heads On's other projects, please visit www.headsoncharity.org.